Page 696, Isaiah chapter 11, verses 1 to 10. And this reading spells out God's plan for the climax of history. God looks forward to the coming of his king, and God tells us in very vivid picture language how this coming king will bring judgment against his enemies and how he will bring salvation for his people. So chapter 11, verse 1. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of power, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes, or decide by what he hears with his ears, but with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. With the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt, and faithfulness the sash around his waist. The wolf will live with the lamb. The leopard will lie down with the goat. The calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear. Their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. The infant will play near the hole of the cobra, and the young child put his hand into the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. In that day the root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the peoples. The nations will rally to him, and his place of rest will be glorious. Now,
then I saw on the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll with writing on both sides and sealed with seven seals. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, "Who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll?" But no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth could open the scroll or even look inside. I wept and wept because no one was found who was worthy to open the scroll or look inside. Then one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep. See the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David? He has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals." Then I saw a lamb, looking as if it had been slain, standing in the center of the throne, encircled by the four living creatures and the elders. He had seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. He came and took the scroll from the right hand of him who sat on the throne. And when he had taken it, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb. Each one had a harp, and they were holding golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And they sang a new song, "You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, because you were slain, and with your body you purchased men for God. From every tribe and language and people and nation, you have made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth." Then I looked and heard the voice of many angels, numbering thousands upon thousands and 10,000 times 10,000. They encircled the throne and the living creatures and the elders. In a loud voice they sang, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and praise." Then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and on the sea and all that is in them singing, "To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be praise and honor and glory and power forever and ever." The four living creatures said, "Amen," and the elders fell down and worshipped.
Thank you very much, David. It would be a great help to me if you were to keep that open in front of you, that Revelation chapter 5, and then we can follow together. Well, the BBC, you may know, issued and distributed the complete set of Pride and Prejudice videos last November, a week before they finished showing the final episode of the serial. So desperate were literally thousands of people, junkies, all over Britain, that many, many stores were sold out by the following Sunday. I want you to imagine for one moment that you weren't one of those who'd bought the video. You've dashed home following the evening service at St. Helens. Don't think we didn't see you. And the drama is unraveling. There's been the enigmatic smile from Darcy across the piano in the drawing room, suggesting the faintest possibility that he hasn't yet given up on Elizabeth. Mrs. Bennet has sent Jane and Bingley out for that long walk, and the little sister's been dispatched to the neighbours, and Darcy has just looked across at Elizabeth and begun that famous sentence, "You must know that my feelings towards you..." The door bursts open, your housemates come crashing in, off goes the telly, and you never get to hear the results. Can you imagine how it would be if all your expectations, all your hopes were simply held in suspension? You could almost weep with agony and frustration. And it's that sort of feeling of frustration and despair and unfulfilled expectation that leads to John's response in verse 4 of our study passage this evening. The words he uses there to describe his crying are literally, "I cried many. I cried much. I wept and wept." It's the phrase that is used of Peter following his denial of Jesus, of Mary at the tomb, of the disciples following Jesus' crucifixion. They cried much. They wept vehemently in the wake of all their dashed hopes and grief and utter despair. So why is it that John weeps in this vehement way? And the reason for that is found in verse 1 as we begin to understand what the scroll represents. "Then I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll with writing on both sides and sealed with seven seals." Way back in Ezekiel chapter 2, where much of the imagery of the revelation here comes from, we see a scroll like this one, and it contains the words of God's judgment. And then at the end of the book of Revelation, we read of the scroll a second and a third time. And again, it contains the judgment of God and the names of those who are going to be rescued by God. Those who are going to dwell in his perfect new heaven and new earth. So the scroll, it seems, represents God's plan for rescue. God's plan to usher in his paradise for his rescued people from every tribe and nation and people group. And it contains also God's plans for his judgment and condemnation on those who have rebelled against him. That's why it's written on both sides. It's absolutely packed. Now can you see and feel the sense of frustration and unfulfilled expectation that grips John? See, as he looked into heaven and saw this glorious vision of God, a mighty angel poses a vital question in verse 2. "I saw a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, 'Who is worthy to break the seals and, as it were, unravel God's plans for the future?'" Then there is a universal search in verse 3. "No one in heaven or on earth or under the earth could open the scroll or even look inside it." They've looked everywhere, up in heaven, down on the earth, even under the earth. There's no holy man on earth, no prophet in the realms of the departed. Nobody in heaven who is worthy to open this scroll and forward God's purposes. Can you sense the frustration? See, we read earlier of God's plans revealed to the prophet and announced by the prophet Isaiah to bring his people into paradise under his rule. And yet as John looks, There's nobody available to do it. You see, without this person, it's fine to say, as we did last week, that God is in charge of his universe. But without this person, there's nobody at the tiller. And the universe is just drifting. Because there's nobody to bring God's final plans to completion. And if God's plans and purposes to present this earth and bring this earth to an end and to usher in judgment and to rescue, if those plans are placed on hold indefinitely, then what is the point of all those people in the seven churches to whom John is writing carrying on enduring as Christians? They're suffering. They're going through a hard time. They're having to stand up for their faith. One of them has been martyred. Many others. Some are in prison. If there is nobody who can usher in God's plans for a glorious new heaven and new earth, there's nobody there worthy to do it, then why bother going on? If there's no point or end or purpose or final conclusion to our universe, then Pink Floyd got it right. For those over 50 and under 30, Pink Floyd are a rock group and not a type of toothpaste. In the 70s, they wrote these words, "All you touch and all you see is all your life will ever be." That's right. If nobody can be found who is worthy to bring God's purposes to conclusion, there'll be no new body for the Christian MS sufferer. No justice ever for the undiscovered rapist. No real forgiveness for past failures. No absolute peace and security, no heaven, no paradise. This is a vision of paradise lost, which is why John weeps. Because as you see, people in the churches to whom he's writing are in prison now. Why keep going? So there is the first point, the universal search. And the universal search has drawn a blank. But then just as John, as it were, dangles on the edge of despair in verse 4, a voice reveals to John something that he has been utterly unable to see for himself. A universal ruler. Verses 5 to 9. Let's have a look at verse 5. "Then one of the elders said to me, 'Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals.'" Now, I don't know if you've ever watched any of those clips of film of the end of World War II or heard any of the soundtracks. I must say I wasn't alive, but even when you listen to them, you hear some of those famous victory speeches, personally I'm moved to tears. Years of suffering and separation and grief and grind. And finally, the consummation of all the plans for victory has come. But here is an announcement of a victory far more universal and with far greater eternal significance. See, it doesn't just affect a few nations in a brief snapshot of time. The victory announced affects the whole of the universe through all time and in all eternity. See, in answer to John's apparently fruitless universal search, the elder announces the victory of the universal ruler. Verse 5. And verse 5 is seen by many as the key verse to the whole book of Revelation. And the reason for it comes as we look at the way the elder has put what he has to say. First, look at the verb. In the original, the verb is right there at the front of the sentence. So it reads, "Behold, has conquered the Lion." And it's put there for emphasis. Has won the Lion. Then notice the verb is in the past tense. Has conquered. And it's in the past tense to emphasize that the victory has already been won. This is no speculative news report of something that's coming up in the future. This is something which has already been accomplished. And then look at the object of the verb in verse 5. Can you see it? There isn't one. See, normally when we announce a victory, well, we'll at least explain who the victory was over. Chelsea have beaten, which is a possibility. The English cricketers have thrashed, which is unlikely unless the opposition have all flown home. But the elder leaves this verb with no object at all. Has conquered the lion. A victory already won over everything. Do you see the point? There has been a mighty universal victory. Then look at the subject. Who is it that has conquered? It's rather odd, isn't it? The conqueror is given in verse 5 two rather strange names. The lion of the tribe of Judah and the root of David. And those names take us right back into the heart of the Old Testament and the culmination and fulfillment of all God's promises to provide a victorious ruler. Just turn over the back of your sheet that you were given as you came in with all the songs and things on. When Jacob, back in Genesis chapter 49, blessed his son Judah, he said, "You are a lion's cub, O Judah, you return from the prey, my son. Like a lion he crouches and lies down, like a lioness, who dares to rouse him? The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until it comes to whom it belongs, and the obedience of the nations is his." Do you see what is being promised to this son of Jacob? He will rule over all nations. The scepter will not depart from him until the obedience of all the nations is his. If you like, until he has won a mighty victory, such that all peoples bow to his rule. And then in the reading we had earlier in Isaiah chapter 11, where God's ruler and rescuer is described. He is described there as the root of Jesse, or the root of David. He is identified and named. And we are told that this ruler in Isaiah chapter 11 will be righteous judge and victor over all evil. He will conquer all God's enemies and usher in God's new heaven and new earth. Now, do you begin to piece together what John is saying in verse 5? Let's read it again. "Then one of the elders said to me, 'Do not weep. See, the lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, this long-promised king, has triumphed. He, therefore, is able to open the scroll.'" So the elder is saying to John, look, get the tissues out. Stop crying. Wipe away the tears. Now look. God's long-promised ruler has won a mighty battle. He is worthy now to usher in God's final purposes and to bring God's people to his promised rest. I wonder what John was expecting to see. A lion, a mighty Aslan or Mufasa figure, a victor who could point back to a masterful strategy and a bloody battle, a warrior figure. Now, I've just been reading General de la Villiers' biography, in which he's the bloke that led the British forces in the Gulf War, and he describes the scenes in New York when he joined Stormin' Norman for the Gulf War victory parade. The Americans do these sort of things rather well. He says it was a remarkable experience as he rode on the lid of his Challenger tank through the streets, and cheering crowds and ribbon-clad streets and people paying tribute to the mighty battle and so on. But you see, in verse 6, as John introduces the second "then I saw" of the chapter, we are shown a completely different scene. Now, there's been a mighty battle and a masterful strategy. He is the long-awaited lion. There's been a glorious conquest and a triumphant conclusion. He has conquered. But when he looked, instead of seeing a triumphant general, where he saw the slaughtered lamb. Standing, ruling, that's what the seven horns represent, all-seeing, all-knowing, but a slaughtered lamb. Did you ever see that epic film El Cid? It's nothing to do with British Gas. Do you remember the scene where Charlton Heston emerges from the besieged city, I think it's Valencia, riding a glorious white charger, dressed in white robes and armor? We all know that he's got a dreadful mortal wound. The arrow has been broken off and the wound is festering. But the wound is hidden in case the armies see that their hero is dying and desert. And he emerges out of the city gates. And as he emerges, the attacking Moors part, bow down, and draw aside. Well, the difference between that scene and this is absolute. The wounds here are gloriously open. The lamb, quite apparently and obviously, has been slaughtered. In that scene, the wounds are hidden in case people desert. In this scene, the wounds are there for all to see, and they are the subject of the praise that follows. Look at verse 8 to 10. When he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb. Each one had a harp, and they were holding golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And they sang a new song, "You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, because you were slain," slaughtered, "and with your blood you purchased men for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. You have made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth." See the answer to the question that was raised in verse 2? Why is he worthy? Because he has been slaughtered. It's a word which is taken from the abattoir and used of killing sacrificial animals. He's not worthy primarily because of who he is, but primarily because of what he has done. He has won a victory by his death. Not because he's God's son, primarily. Not because he's lived a perfect life, primarily. Not because of his perfect example, primarily, but because he has been slaughtered. And if we're going to get to the bottom of this, we have to do one last piece of research. We saw, you see, earlier in Isaiah, a picture of a glorious ruler who would bring peace for God's people, who would enable them to enter his perfect paradise, the new heaven and the new earth, under his perfect rule. But any student of the Old Testament, or human history for that matter, will be able to tell us that a dream like that is simply impossible to realize whilst you and I are as we are. And there have been loads of people dreaming utopian dreams for as long as anybody can remember. Freddie Mercury, I think, was probably the latest over Christmas. "This could be heaven for everyone. This world could be fair. This world could be fun. This could be heaven for everyone." Remember hearing that being sung? And in the same soundbite of mass graves in Bosnia, family breakups in Britain. See, every utopian dream has always floundered when it comes to dealing with the problem of our own human sinfulness. Anybody who's honest simply has to admit that heaven would be hell if I were there with all my selfishness and so on. Which is why back in the book of Isaiah in chapter 53, page 740, if you wouldn't mind turning to it, God promises a solution to human rebellion. Verse 4. He promises a servant who will come and take up our infirmities and carry away our sorrows. Yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Do you see what God is doing? He is promising to Isaiah that he will provide a solution to all that prevents his perfect plan of rescue and a new heaven and new earth coming into being. He will provide a solution for our sinfulness, one who will take up our infirmities, one who will be pierced for our transgression, one on whom all the punishment and sin and rebellion of each and every one of God's people will be laid. He will be pierced, crushed. Iniquities will be laid on him. Now look at verse 7. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter. Same word. I guess it's possible, isn't it, for us at the end of the 20th century to take our focus off the central significance of Jesus' death in all of God's plans and purposes for eternity for the universe. I guess it would have been possible for people to have missed its significance back there in 33 AD when it took place. If we'd seen Jesus on the cross, well, we might just have walked past. We might have walked by, turned our eyes away in disgust, think nothing more than what a pitiful wretch. But the heavenly courtiers in Revelation chapter 5 interpret his death for us. He is God's long-promised, long-awaited lion of the tribe of Judah, the ruler over heaven and earth. He is the Lamb who was slain. And as he hung there on the cross, God's full anger at our rebellion and filth and sin was heaped upon him, verse 9, so that he might purchase men and women for God from every tribe and language and people and nation, in order to fulfill God's purposes for his people. Do you see the central significance of the cross? The death of Jesus, God's universal ruler, makes him worthy in Revelation 5 to stand right at the center of God's ruling throne. And on the basis of his death, he is worthy to free God's people from the consequences of sin, to secure a new place for them in paradise for eternity, and to be the one who overthrows all God's enemies. Now I want to make just 2 points in application. First is this: how do we view the death of Jesus? I mean, it's possible, isn't it, for us Christians just to grow slightly blasé, or maybe bored, or even possibly embarrassed about Jesus' death. Yes, Jesus died for my sins. Oh, I know that. I learned it in Sunday school. But isn't it time to move on to something else? I mean, all this talk of sin and human rebellion is fine, but isn't there something a bit more exciting? I mean, what is God doing today? Isn't there something more tangible and dramatic? Something we can get slightly more excited about? Something we can talk to our friends about when we're talking to them about Jesus? Some great sign, some great contemporary act. But as we glance into heaven, the angels in heaven aren't looking for anything more exciting or dramatic than the cross. It is the victory. And they're looking back to it and praising God for it as the slaughtered lamb reigns at the center of God's throne. It's possible, I guess, for us to want to go for a picture of the throne room that we saw last week that has all the splendor of chapter 4, all the dazzle, the movement, the removed majesty and awe and power of God, but to want to sort of sidestep the talk about the sin and the cross and Jesus. And following last week's sermon, I heard of a Freemason who'd been here and was comparing the imagery of the universal rule of God with some of the Masonic themes. I guess a Jew or a Muslim or even a New Ager might be happy with chapter 4. But chapter 5 changes it completely. John looked throughout heaven and earth for somebody who was worthy to bring God's plans to their completion. Nobody could be found until he was shown by revelation a view of the center of the throne with Jesus and his cross right at the center. And the angels aren't ashamed to sing about the cross as the one unique final victory of God. He is worthy because he was slaughtered. And the second area of application is this: the way in which we view Jesus' death will have direct results on the way we view the events of our life today. Once we realize that Jesus' death is what enables God's plans to be brought to their conclusion, and for the new heaven and the new earth eventually to be ushered in with God's people in it, once we realize that, then that will spur us on to service and endurance. Think of the Christians of the seven churches to whom John was writing. Frightened, lonely, weak, abused, discriminated against, mentally and physically suffering. Why do you think John puts this here? Why do you think he's shown the already completed victory? Well, because once we realize that the Lion of the tribe of Judah has conquered, God's purposes cannot be thwarted because the victory has already been won, then we will be able to persevere to the end. So there we are, our universal search for the one who is worthy, a universal ruler who is worthy because of his death. And now as we close, I'm simply going to read verses 11 through to 14. Take a moment to read through from verse 6 to 10. Contemplate the cross. What is the position in which the cross is in your life? What position do you hold the cross in yourself? Is it as central as it is in John's vision of heaven? And then I shall read verses 11 to 14. Then I looked and heard the voice of many angels, numbering thousands upon thousands, and 10,000 times 10,000. They encircled the throne and the living creatures and the elders. In a loud voice they sang, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth, and wisdom, and strength, and honor, and glory, and praise." Then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and on the sea, and all that is in them singing, "To him who sits on the throne, and to the Lamb be praise, and honor, and glory, and power, for ever and ever." The four living creatures said, "Amen." And the elders fell down and worshipped.